Good morning. It is the 2nd of August, and I just noticed I have not switched out the calendar yet. It still says July. Dad yesterday was saying, are you going to change the calendar because it's not July anymore? And I guess I did not get an opportunity to do that yet.
That's denial about getting out of July.
Yeah. That age thing, it doesn't work. I found that out.
Let's go back to July.
No, let's go back to May if we're going to do it.
I know, it's wild.
Well, nice to see you've been outside a little bit, huh?
Yeah.
Refreshingly tan.
Yeah, I have more tan than normal. So.
Yeah, we won't ask about lines either.
I actually have.
Just roll.
That's where I don't have tan. Is in my roll lines.
Are you ready for our, why do we say it?
I am ready. I was looking up all kinds of stuff last night, hoping to be ready.
Okay, yen.
Yen.
Why do we say yen?
I have no idea.
Good.
Is it like urine?
Yeah, it's a typo.
I got it. Okay, I'm done. Move on.
Sailors and other adventurers were among the earliest Europeans to spend any length of time in China. There's no reference to Pelosi, but I guess the timing works. Some who managed to penetrate the Forbidden Land came home reporting that entry was easiest in the Peking area. That part of China, they reported, was unusual in another respect. Everywhere a man went, he was likely to walk into a crowded room in which the smoke was thick. It was hard to breathe in such an atmosphere, and the smoke seemed to have unexpected effects on the person who inhaled it. Okay. Devotees of such smoke were afflicted with what the speakers of the Cantonese dialect called yin-yang, or craving for more of it. Anyone having yin-yang was clearly subject to some powerful force. Abbreviated in Western speech, yin came to designate any strong appetite or passionate craving. Not until later generations was it known that the earliest and one of the strongest kinds of yin-yang, or yen, resulted from smoking opium. Today, a person who wouldn't be caught dead experimenting with opium might admit to having a yen for anything ranging from soul food to Major League Baseball to candy.
Yeah, and opioids.
Yeah, fentanyl.
It's all, unfortunately, it's all too applicable. It's like most things. You look them up and, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, right? So you read something and go, oh, those people, they were so dumb. And then you realize, oh, well, we kind of do a form of that now. So.
Yeah. It's reflectiveness, huh?
Yeah. I would probably learn more about myself if I would bother to reflect. But anyway, I think it's better to just, you know,
form my
opinion about other people. You know, because we humans are born with great hypocrisy detectors. They're just not self-detecting.
Oh, I thought that we had been told not to get too close to mirrors so we don't reflect.
There's other reasons that you and I should avoid mirrors.
Exactly. I thought today we could, you know, one of the things that I think a lot of folks are unaware of is that you and your industry and your expertise don't just crunch numbers. You know, it's not just column adding. There's a lot more to it. I think a couple of years ago, I know we spent one on some of the business suggestions and acumens and things. But I was thinking for those setting up wills, and we both have had buddies in the last little bit who have passed this mortal coil, and most have got wills and have people who are set up to be able to further their wishes. And we both have had buddies who didn't. Maybe they did and no one can find it.
Yeah.
Or. So I thought, you know.
Yeah, and there have been some famous people that have died intestate, you know, without a will.
Yeah.
And which is remarkable, but I mean, it's also one of those things that they thought they never were going to, or they were, you know, maybe they thought
tomorrow.
Yeah. Or maybe they thought it's not going to be my problem. I don't know.
This will get even with them.
Yeah. I don't have anybody I like. I'm going to make somebody suffer.
Yeah. So I guess let's start with the simplest. If someone is married,
yeah,
do they need a will?
So let me just preface one thing before.
You're not a lawyer.
I'm not a lawyer, but we do as it's, you know, I do interact a lot with wills and trusts. I don't write them. Sometimes attorneys ask me, you know, ask us to look at the documents as they're being prepared for feedback about particular issues. I mean, you know, much of a will or a trust document is boilerplate. So, but the parts that aren't, the standard language, those can be very, very important, particularly because everybody's situation is so different. You know, we've talked about it before.
Well, or just
with the context of taxation.
Their interests are, or their wishes. I mean, even in those simple areas. Yeah.
Even you can take two people in a neighborhood who seemingly have similar jobs, similar income levels, similar houses, and their tax situation is really different. And the same can be their assets can be very different, even though you might look on the surface that they have two cars and a house but it's the other stuff you can't see that can make a situation very different. So I digress from your original question, which was about married people. I guess the other piece of groundwork I'd like to lay is that a will, many people, if you have a trust, generally you're going to have a will as well. Okay. And the will, in that case, then the will has a different function.
It kind of gets folded in, doesn't
right.
it?
Right. Usually they're written over as what we call a pour-over will. But so typically what happens when a person just has a will is that's a document that says, upon my passing, the following things shall occur. And a will is administratively subject to a process called probate. And probate is a government process which supervises the administration of wills in terms of so the court has supervision over the administration of a will. So if I have a will and it says, and I'm not married, and the will says, upon my demise, kid A gets this, kid B gets that. And it's different. Well, then whoever I name as my executor, and that's the person who administers a will, they're going to have to follow those rules. So they have kind of an interesting path to go.
Direction, yeah. And responsibilities, I would think.
Yeah.
KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:19.
Hi there, and good evening, and welcome to the Jim Bohannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Weekdays at 7 p.m., it's the Jim Bohannon Show. I'm Jim Bohannon. Join me here on KINS.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time, 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Bill McCauley. So we've got these terms that you've referenced, trust, a will, estate, executor, trustee.
Yeah.
All obviously have some interconnectedness
right.
to one another. For folks that are unfamiliar, what is needed and what's the best way to get there?
So, this whole landscape is a little unusual. And some people are familiar with it, and all those terms make sense. And other people go, "What do you mean? There's a will, And so
there's a difference between baking powder and baking soda,
right?
Huh.
And so yeah, you know, when, yeah, you know, going back to the example of somebody having a will, going through the process of probate, that will creates, you know, by administering that will, you need to create an estate. Okay, so you know, if you think that there's, you know, some terms that are used together are will, executor, and estate. Because those things, if you have a will without a trust, it generally will create an estate unless all the assets are in community property, and then they transfer just via community property without requiring court supervision.
So that would be the spouse.
Correct.
If there
or
was.
It can be a child. You know, property can be placed into you know, a joint account, joint tenancy. Community property would be a spouse. That often requires some form of an agreement, you know, because typically. So anyway, you're in
there. There's details.
There's details about the title of assets. But the point being, when we talk about somebody having an estate, that's an administrative entity created by a will and administered by an executor. This is the typical language.
So does an executor, is that something that has to, or someone that has to be formally recognized? Are there credentials associated with that?
Great question. The court appoints or confirms an executor appointment, so in a document called letters testamentary. So when someone dies, the original will is lodged with the court, and a document is filed by an attorney, in my experience, and that creates, the court goes ahead and looks at the will and says, yeah, this person X has been named as the executor, and the court confirms that with a document called letters testamentary, which is used to then go to the, that document is then needed in some cases to open a bank account or other things. But that's the beginning of the court saying, okay, this person's now responsible as the executor for this estate.
And if a trust exists, that step is nullified or has already occurred?
So let's talk a little bit about the differences. So in a trust, unless there's litigation, it's not generally court supervised at all. So keep in mind that probate, which is done for and you can end up with probate with a trust, but, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but probate is a process that occurs for a will or for assets that are not included in a trust, and that's a public court supervised process. A trust administration does not necessarily require any court supervision. Sometimes there is court supervision when there are contentious beneficiaries or other matters that need to be resolved by the court, or sometimes a trustee might look for court approval of something that's been done simply to make sure that they're crossing their I's and dotting their T's because of the long-term potential liability that somebody could come back later and say, wait a minute,
there's a residual.
Yeah. Some it just depends but in general, most trusts are administered without any court supervision, is my experience. And so,
but does that matter, the size of the estate?
Yes. So if an estate is very small, it may not. For lack of a better term, and there is an actual legal term for this, but there's a quickie probate. It's kind of a scaled down version.
You mean that is it, the legal term?
Yeah, it's the probate EZ, right?
Yeah.
So for small, very small, modest estates, they can be administered kind of on a more expedited process through probate. And then most cases, if you have a will and there's an absence of a trust and it's going to be probated, then in most cases it goes through a full probate. That whole process involves getting inventories of assets, and the inventories go to the court and say, okay, this is the assets of the date of death. And then sometimes there's additional supplemental inventories as additional assets are located
or
identified. So anyway, there's a process that you go through the same process as a trustee of a trust. The difference is, if I form the trust, you're not filing a court document saying this is my inventory of assets. You're just going, okay, yeah, we knew we had this thing, but we had to get more information to fully identify it and understand what the value is, but we don't have to report that to the court. We're just expanding our list of initial assets that were on hand at the start of the trust. So with a trust, most people have a trust and an estate, or pardon me, and a will, and the will generally be a pour-over will to a trust, and it says, hey, if we miss something, dump it in the trust and administer it with the other assets. The trust document then specifies, here, these are the steps that are to be taken to administer the trust. This is what happens upon the death of the first spouse, what happens upon the death of the second spouse, and so they're very, very specific.
It's a game plan, so to speak.
Correct.
Yeah. KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:30.
Something big.
Okay, it's a nice ride.
It's going to happen.
Stand by playback.
And now.
Live. Real Red Meat Radio.
I keep forgetting I'm president.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And these kids who come, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans.
Now, here's your host, Lars Larson.
Hey there, it's Lars Larson. Join me for the Lars Larson Show, weeknights 10 to midnight. Honestly provocative talk radio on KINS.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:35. We're back Talking Shop this morning with Bill McCauley. Bill, regarding the execution of wills, estates, things of that nature, you know, you got the lawyers on the front end making sure everything's all put together, and then there are implications of those decisions also that are down the road. What are some of the areas that people will either underestimate, overestimate, not really grasp that drops into somebody's lap, either the executor or the surviving spouse, or you mentioned
joint tenant.
Thanks. That are some of those pitfalls that we want to avoid if we can.
Well, the first thing I would say about trust administration, which is to me a little more common than estate administration. We just don't see as many estates created by wills. We seem to have more clients with trust documents. That may be the profile of our client base or whatever. But when we see with trust administration, you know, first thing I think is really important when someone is executing the trust as was created by the decedent in this case, then you need to communicate. You know, I think communication is really important. Beneficiaries get nervous in the absence of information. And so it's one of those things that I think as an executor of a will, in the capacity as a trustee of a trust, I think it's really important to plan for communication and think about how, you know, what processes are we going to create. Does that mean you should be getting a phone call every night at 10 p.m. with stream of consciousness questions? No, that's not fair. But does that mean that you should be available to answer questions, you know, in a reasonable timeline, or have a process for saying, hey, you know, here's the way I want, you know, I got an issue. Here's how I want to raise my hand. I'll send you an email and raise my hand saying I got questions. And then the trustee then says, you know, within a couple days, unless I'm in Alaska, I'll call you back, or whatever the case might be. And so, you know, it's creating, I think, reasonable expectations on both ends, saying to a beneficiary, look, this is what you can expect from me, and this is kind of what I'm expecting from you. I mean, I think about it that, you know, in terms of when I used to coach youth sports, I used to communicate with the parents up front and say, here's how I want this to work. If you have an issue, I want you to bring it to me, and here's when. I don't want you to come up to me in the middle of a practice or in the middle of a game and tell me what your issue is. I want you to do that. And, you know, and so the point being,
ground rules.
I think it's really good to be up front and say, look, if you, and I act as trustee, and I've acted as executor as well. But I act as trustee fairly regularly, and I've currently probably got three or four things that I'm currently the active trustee. I guess more than probably at least four. The point with that is I try to communicate very quickly. You know, if you have questions, I want you to contact me. I don't want you sitting there wondering, because it's human nature. It would be the exception to not be this way. We get a little suspicious in the absence of information. So I think that's really important. So that's really one thing, you know, if you're going to act as a trustee or an executor, I think communication is very important. Getting a game plan. Here's how this is going to work. Here's when you can contact me, all that stuff. The next thing, you know, that somebody who's in that position needs to start thinking about is figuring out what's out there. I mean, so I've seen different situations. I've seen people acting as trustee who had very little information about what the assets were in the trust, and yet they're trying to figure it out. And they're looking at me going, I don't know what's there. And so I'm saying, well, I can look at the tax return and I can tell you they get income from these, this, 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 and this. Those must be assets. And there might be some more, right? Because there's some things that don't generate income, but they might be an asset. They might have a
Maserati.
They might have a piece of land. They might have coins. And
that would leave, you know, if they're taxes. I mean, I would think would be something you'd ferret out.
You would think so, from the standpoint that there'd be, if you looked at the prior tax return, you'd see some property taxes.
Something, yeah.
From that and so there are breadcrumbs. But sometimes they aren't necessarily immediately clear. And that's the thing when I create my trust, well, I know what's there. I know what's in that. I know what that universe looks like. But to somebody else stepping in, they're not necessarily going to know, oh, well, there's a coin collection or there's a stamp collection or there's, in your case, a baseball card collection or whatever the case might be. It's possible somebody doesn't really know that or they don't have any idea where it is and how to get to it. You know, oh, that's in a safe deposit box. What bank?
Yeah.
You know, all
what
this
city,
stuff,
what bank?
You know,
yeah.
And so you think about it saying, you know, if you don't know that, and then you're trying to pull the thread back to figure out when did they pay for a safe deposit box. The other day I went in to renew my safe deposit box and I handed them, it was a fee and I handed them cash. Nobody's going to see that in my records that there's a safe deposit box at fill in the blank. Bank,
yeah, there's no footprint.
Redwood Capital Bank. The point being, nobody's going to necessarily, that isn't necessarily a string you can pull. So then you've got to go out and do some detective work to try to figure out where.
All of which takes time and effort and.
Yeah. And if you're. All that takes a lot of time. So sometimes just marshaling the assets and figuring out what's, you know, and then you get assets like life insurance policies. Okay, so let's say you have three life insurance policies, and one of them's with insurance company A, the other one's with insurance company B, and the other one's insurance company C. Why we have multiple insurance companies? I don't know, it doesn't matter. The point is, each one of them is gonna have a different process for applying for that life insurance. They're gonna ask for different documents. They're gonna have entirely different forms. Some of them are going to require things to be notarized. Other insurance companies won't require a notarization, but they're going to require an attest statement about generation skipping taxes for estate planning. And then the other companies don't ask for that. And you get to this thing and you think, wow, it is remarkable how different each insurance company's application process is. That all takes time, energy, etc. It's difficult enough sometimes just to get in and get to the banks and get things changed based on and finding the documents that they're going to need to get the account and get the new trustee on as a signer.
Sounds like it's almost a specialty, being executors or trusts.
It requires an trustees. Iron butt in some cases. So, you know, you really got to be able to sit in the seat.
KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:43.
Hi folks, Fly Humboldt wants to remind you that flying local is buying local. And with airlines going to seven cities serving hundreds of destinations, it's easier than ever to get to where you want to go from Humboldt County's airport. That's right, you can fly on American, Avelo, and United Airlines nonstop to Denver, Hollywood, Burbank, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. Flying has never been more convenient or affordable, so book your trip now. For more information, go to flyhumboldt.org.
Good morning, KINS. News and information time is 8:48. We're back talking shop this morning with Bill McCauley. Bill, so what are some of the challenges that are out there? You mentioned communication being a huge one. I would like to think that somebody would tend to review and make sure that there's enough information so that the level of desire at least is closely met when you're gone or when the author is gone. What are some of those last-minute things that really... or the details, well, I guess, it can make it easier for everybody.
Well, record-keeping, you know, of course, this is my bias because we end up dealing with the records, but record-keeping is really important. A person needs to keep a good record of each receipt and each disbursement so that tax returns can be done if there's a need.
This is at post-death.
Post-death, yeah.
Got things
and
rolling
so,
now. Yeah.
Because that record-keeping element is important, who, you know, when you're naming someone to serve in this capacity, they should have attention to detail or have someone very nearby them who has attention to detail who can very actively support that.
Steer them back into, yeah.
Right. So it's, you know, that whole record-keeping element is really important because, you know, look, trust administration is kind of expensive anyway. And you know, if you're using a CPA to do the tax
work. A pro, yeah.
We charge based on the amount of time it takes. So the better your records, the less time, and the lower the fee. The bigger the mess, the more...
the bigger the bill.
Yeah, the bigger the bill. Yeah. And so it's one of those things. And it's not just that. It's more about being able to establish to beneficiaries, this is what happened. This is what I've done. Because
you can recreate it
so you can say, hey, we're going to provide an accounting to the beneficiary so they can see what happened from day one, you know, which every receipt, every disbursement.
How narrow? Postage for paying bills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, so you've got time to do it. The stamp. You've got the envelope, and you've got at some point it becomes so granular. Is it really worth tracking?
Well, that's true, except you know, if it came out of the trust, you have an obligation to be able to account for it as a trustee, or if it came out of the estate as an executor, you need to be able to say what every dollar or every penny that went out, you should be able to identify where did it go.
Right, you buy a box of envelopes. Yeah. Is that worth asking or having those charges reimbursed?
In my opinion, maybe not, but as a practical matter, I don't know. Some people are very detail-minded, but how do you say, I bought a box of 200 envelopes and you're going to use 30 of them for the project? What are you going to do with the 170 that's left over? So, I mean, I think as a practical matter, those supplies things aren't as big an issue. But I do think the bigger point is if you don't have attention to detail and you don't keep good records, the likelihood of having... an expensive administration and challenges is greater.
You shouldn't be in that function.
Yeah,
I guess. And I think that must be part of the critical decision making is the selection of that person.
Yes.
You know, if you don't get somebody who's detail oriented, or the estate isn't big enough to hire somebody without sucking up, you know, a third of the estate to accomplish that.
Mm-hmm.
You're kind of betwixt and between.
That choice is important, and sometimes you know, parents want to appoint their kids, but do you appoint one of them, or do you appoint all of them, or do you appoint? You know, there's all these questions, and there's pros and cons to each course of action. It depends on the number of kids, and are they all from the same set of parents, or do you have blended families? All those things become major issues in the estate planning process to try to figure out, okay, what should we be doing administratively?
At what point do you hire a pro?
Always.
Well, I'm thinking, if the estate is $10 million,
yeah.
Okay, and there's two beneficiaries or three beneficiaries, that might be a threshold point. Or is it $50 million, or at what point does it make sense, and at what point doesn't it make sense?
Well, that's a great question. Unfortunately, I don't think we have time to fully delve into it, but probably at those levels, all of them would need a pro.
Fair enough. Thanks for coming by. Have a fun trip. See everybody tomorrow. Okay.